Let me see if I can get Miss Allen in here now. Let me see. Jerry Allen. Can you hear me now, Jerry? This is very, very strange for this. Let me see. I can't hardly get you in. Okay, can you hear me now? I know, and I don't know what's wrong. Let me see if I can get you down just a little bit here, okay? Let me see something. Let me see. Okay?
Okay.
All right. How are you, Jerry?
How am I?
Yeah, how are you?
I'm fine. I feel like I can't hear you too well, so I don't...
I tell you what.
...what you're saying to me, but I'm hearing you faintly.
Okay, I tell you what. As long as you can hear me, they can hear you.
Okay.
You credit, I can't get it together. I can't get it together. Let me see if I can get it together, Jerry. Just be patient with me, honey. Be patient. Let me see. How's that? Let me see. Ooh, I hate it. I hate this. Anyway, as long as you can hear me, they can hear you. Okay?
Okay, I can pick up a little bit of what you're saying.
Okay. You credit your home environment with building a good foundation as far as music. Can you share what that environment was like in your home as, say, like a child?
Well, my parents, both of them had, my father's living still, but both my father and mother have always had a strong commitment to exposing us to the arts, both my brother and I. So early on, we were listening to a lot of music, live music and concerts, and there was a lot of music around the house, and we would do things like take drawing classes and dance classes. And I don't know if they expected either of us to really get into any of those things. But because of those experiences, I sort of gravitated toward music, you know. I sort of found my particular music. And my father was a real avid jazz listener. And he had a big collection. He still does. A big collection of music of Charlie Parker and Duke Ellington. And so we were hearing that music probably in the womb, you know, and throughout our childhood growing up.
Oh yeah, look, as long as you can hear me, it's fine. Well, during this time, how old were you, and what practice habits did you have then?
I'm sorry.
How old were you during this time?
How old was I?
Uh huh.
Well, I started playing piano when I was 7, and I think I became more aware of the influence that my father's love for jazz had on me once I was in high school years. But I was hearing the music all through that time, and also the music of Motown and all the popular music that was being aired and that was happening in Detroit at that time. So I think by high school I sort of became aware of you know, the great influence that hearing all this music had on me.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did Marcus Belgrave help you with during the time that you were a artist and the resident? Artist residence program at Cass Tech, right?
Right. He was. Wow, that was really something. It was in, I think, 1973 that I first met him. And Detroit Public Schools had, and there's still a school there, Cass Technical High School, which a lot of musicians have come through, like Donald Byrd was there, and mm-hmm. and Ron Carter was there, and I can really list a lot of great musicians who have come through there. And there was a teacher who was very progressive named Marilyn Jones, whose husband played improvised trombone. So she knew the value of having somebody who was really a musician and really out there for the kids to be involved with. because they had a jazz ensemble along with many, many different music ensembles. It was like a special a preparatory school for music. And school, so a lot of people came there just for the music. And Marcus, I first met in 73, and he headed the jazz ensemble there. And just to give you an idea, a few of the musicians that were in that little group, there was a guy named Greg Fillinganes, who I really looked up to. And all the piano players looked up to him because he was an obvious great talent. And now he's musical director for Michael Jackson and doing a whole lot of that, the studio things that you hear coming out of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fellow named Eli Fontaine who works under Max Roach now, the great Max Roach, in the group Oom Boom. And he tours all around the country doing different theater things. So there are a couple of us that kept going after that from that jazz ensemble. And Marcus had a direct influence on all of us.
What kind of activities were going on at Cass Tech?
Well, the regular things that high school kids do. Trouble, some trouble. Some. I think school itself was really well structured in the sense that... if you came there being interested in chemistry, they had a whole set of specific things that maybe you would be doing in freshman year of college that you would be doing toward your last couple of years in high school there. And the same with every other field, whether it was the visual arts or music or whatever it was, you were sort of prepared directly for your first year of college. Outside of that, there were a lot of independent things that would happen outside of school with the musicians. I remember Marcus having a group called the Jazz Development Workshop around that time. And he pulled a lot of young musicians, not only from Cass, but from all over Detroit, into this sort of workshop setting. And we, people like Kenny Garrett, who's now plays with Miles Davis, and Bob Hurst, who's now plays with Bradford Marcellus. All these guys, you know, were very young, but very talented very early. You could hear that they were really directed. And basically, what Marcus did was put us in a setting, put a lot of the young musicians in a setting with the more stellar musicians of the Detroit area, the people who were already the masters of the music. So we had a chance to sit right next to these people and see the distance between where we were and where they are, where they were, and it was really a great experience. We even got the city to pay for a summer of us doing the workshop every day from 9 to 5, one of the school summer programs for the kids that had gotten out of school. So we actually got paid to rehearse for one summer, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was something that I was going to say. It seemed like your growing interest in music, especially jazz, around that time, it led you to enroll in Howard University's Jazz Studies program. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, excuse me, my father went to a black school, and during the time that we were making decisions about where to go, where I was going to go, he always talked about the importance of us going, even if we only went for a year, that we should go. And I remember hearing about Donald Byrd, who I had met through a Madrigal group that the woman I mentioned before, Marilyn Jones, had. I sang in a Madrigal group, which is like a 16th century European music group. at CAF, and we went to Australia on for a music educators conference there, and Donald Byrd helped raise money for us to go. So we met him at that time, and so after finding out that he was at Howard and knowing the great musician that he is and he was, and you know, the Blackbirds were there, Kevin Tony was there, and there were just a lot of reasons to go, so I decided to make my way down there, although I missed Donald Byrd by a semester because he left the semester that I came there. But Howard was one of the great experiences for me, culturally and in all kinds of ways. It was really a great experience.
Well, during this time, I think that you got I think it was an NEA grant to study with Kenny Barron, but you got a call from Nathan Davis. I wanted you to talk about that one.
Oh, boy. Well, as many people do, there was a strong pull for me to want to go to New York. So once I graduated from Howard, Marcus Belgrave and Roy Brooks, a great drummer, also from Detroit, Michigan, who works in the same group, Oom Boom, I spoke about before with Max Roach. They came and they came up and did a performance in my senior recital, which was a major, major moment in my life, you know. And after the recital, I found out from Marcus that I had gotten this grant, which meant that I was going to be able to go to New York and have a little bit of a cushion, you know. And I spoke with Kenny Barron, and he was really very, very, very nice about me using the money to survive up there as opposed to giving him the majority of the money. So when I got to New York, I found an apartment with some people there and just stayed there. I guess it must have been just a summer's worth of time. And I was studying with Kenny every week and meeting people and sort of, you know, just overwhelmed by all of everything that was around me. But it was a very exciting time. Nathan Davis called me toward the end of the summer and says, look, I have this this opening for this teacher's assistantship position here at Pittsburgh, but you have to come right now. So I was sort of at the end of the money that I had, and I certainly wasn't getting any work. And nobody knew me from Adam, and that's the way it is here. It takes quite a bit of time to break in unless you come in a situation that's already established, which I hadn't done. But the experience of being there and seeing what New York, the challenge that New York presented, was very healthy. But I was very fortunate to get out of there at that point. So beyond the fact that I was coming into a situation where I could go to school again, which was a great blessing, I also got out of something that I wasn't ready for at that time. So I have a lot to thank Dr. Davis for.
Well, you know what? Yeah. I was noticing around this time too that you were that you almost began to shun away from pianists and concentrate on a cat who I think was a tremendous influence on his music, Eric Dolphy. What was so special about Eric Dolphy?
Well, the thing is, when I came to Pittsburgh, that was in 79, and I sort of gotten into a group of musicians who were known as the Loft Musicians, and they were in New York, and they had set up new venues to perform the music that was true to them, because the clubs were not open or amenable to this music. So they set up a whole new, I think the Ladies' Fort was a place. There are a lot of places, because I wasn't there, but I knew some of the musicians because of some ties from people in Detroit, like Dwight Andrews and Furon Akhlaf. And from knowing them, I met Oliver Lake and James Newton and Anthony Davis and people like that who were directly involved in the loft scene. So that it really interested me. And when you look at that, I think that there's, within our tradition, there's a really direct continuum from era to era, things that were connecting, that were bringing these musicians to come to the ideas that they had come to from future, from people that had come before them. And Eric Dolphy, I think, was a major influence on many of these. I know on Oliver Lake specifically, very directly, and he performs a great deal of Eric Dolphy's music. But I became really interested in Dolphy, just as I've been interested in many of the great musicians from our history. At that particular time, I just felt a very strong. It's hard to explain. I mean, you listen to something and you feel something that you can understand and you can relate to, and was very inspirational for me. And especially knowing that Nathan Davis had worked with Eric Dolphy and spent a great deal of time with him as a friend, made it a very, when I decided to do my thesis on him, which I did, it really gave a lot of validity to it, because there was someone there that I could really speak to directly about the man who knew him and who could direct me. So I became very involved in transcribing and analyzing his music, because I wanted it to rub off on me too. So I wrote about him as a person, researched his life, but I also had the benefit of studying his music very closely.
Well, you know, on your LP called The Printmakers, you did a composition called Eric, and we're going to play this right now. This is coming from The Printmakers, Jerry Allen on piano, Anthony Cox on bass, and special guest Andrew Serrero on drums, mouth percussion, and timpani. So, Jerry, can you hold on a minute? Thank you. Oh, yeah, and you're hearing the exciting sounds of Jerry Allen, and you just heard a thing called Eric, and in the background, like you're hearing a tune called Running as Fast as You Can. Yes, Jerry Allen from her LP, The Printmakers. And Jerry is on the other end, but she was talking about Saxie Williams, and Saxie happened to do a gig with Jerry Allen and Marcus Belgrave, and she wants to have me put Saxie on so he could tell the story so Jerry could follow up on it. So I'm going to see if I can get him in here. Saxie.
Peace.
How you doing?
Fine, thank God.
Can you make this this story that you was telling me, right? Jerry wants to hear it so she can just relate to it, okay?
Okay, I'm going to try it. Not over talk, but I want to say God bless you, and I hope you live forever, because you are really doing a much needed constructive thing for the music. You are a dedicated human being, you know, and I'm so grateful and proud of you, man, and you're the well needed voice after Buck passed and Amir Rashid and all of them left. You understand what I'm saying? God bless you. But it just so happens that a lot of people in high places, like people at college who have master's degrees, are not aware of the integral part that the tap dancer played into jazz, our greatest American art form. And people like Roy Brooks, who had been with Eddie Jefferson and knew about it, and grew up in a tap dancing town, which Detroit was the town that paddling and rolling was invented by a guy named Monty. And anyway, Roy Brooks came through here, and through Jerry Farmer, he sought me out and took me to the Left Bank Jazz Society in Baltimore, which was Baby Lawrence's hometown, and that was one of the crowning events of my life into this great American art form of jazz and tap. And in the band was Marcus Belgrave and a real outstanding tenor saxophonist. I can't think of his name now, but that's when I met Jerry Allen, and I was mesmerized by her, not only her artistic qualities, but her ladylike and humanistic portion she had. She reminded me of a thing where God brought her to take Mary Lou Williams' place. I mean, that's the way I feel about her, because I can see Mary Lou Williams all over through her, and it further helped me to show people how tap dance is an integral part and a basic part of jazz.
Yeah. You know, and she wanted to hear this so she can comment on it, man. Hey, man, thanks, man.
Thank you. God bless you, and I hope he protects you and keeps you giving this much needed voice of edutaining the people about your passion for the music. God bless you. And God bless you, Jerry, and you are getting what you deserve, and I know you're going to the moon. God bless you too. Peace.
Yes, Jerry, did you hear that?
Yeah, that was beautiful. That was really beautiful. I remember coming up in Detroit and Marcus putting on these concerts that would include the great tap dancers of Detroit, and then we'd have a vocalist that would come up, then we'd have somebody who would tell jokes.
Yeah.
And we'd have a whole big band come up and play. And when I look at some of the clips from the Apollo, the older clips, one of them is Joe Harris is in this clip with Dizzy Gillespie, and he's got these great spats on, and the band is playing, and there's so much going on. The thing that used to happen with the music was that there were so many dimensions to the experience of the music and the experience of the voice and tap dancing and all of these things would happen in the course of one night, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the music. And so growing up, I had the experience of working with many tap dancers in Detroit because of Marcus and Roy. And sometimes Roy would get up himself and dance, you know, from the drums.
Yeah.
And we'd always get history whenever we were around them. And he talked about the fact that most drummers from his age and forward, most of the drummers were tap dancers too. And they could get up and dance, or at least they knew the basics of it if they weren't the masters at Saxy Williams, people like that. But I think coming to Pittsburgh and having the experience to work with Saxy, as well as the great tap dancers from Detroit, like Lloyd Story and people like that, we did an album called The Dancer that had a tap dancer named Lloyd Story involved in it, and those experiences always, I don't know, it's something you hold on to, those things, those great memories, you know, and somehow those things will come back again, you know, in your composition, in your writing, and in the most interesting ways, you know. Everybody that you touch, everybody that touches you has such a great impact on, has had such a great impact on me. And I want to say thank you, Saxy.
Yeah, I know he...
in Pittsburgh, friends and great musicians who, during those 4 years that I was there, have made a great impact on me. Joe Harris, it's really going to be something, because there's so many people, you know. Nathan Davis was responsible for getting me there. And I met many, many, many great musicians as a result of the time that I had to spend in Pittsburgh. And, I just want to say thank you to so many, you know, there are many, many great musicians there and that were there at the time. You know, Pittsburgh's music tradition is such a great one. And there's a wealth of knowledge to be learned from the people that have come out of there. Mary Lou Williams, the Saxy Mission, is a great influence. Her music, her writing, her life, the fact that she, all the things that she's done has made it possible for me and many of the women musicians that I know to be doing what we're doing. Without the difficulties that she went through as a young woman coming up in the music, and she is a trailblazer, and she sort of set the path to make it possible for us. And there's a whole the Smithsonian did recently a study on Mary Lou Williams. And I had the opportunity to work on some of her music, and there's something there. I'm going to continue my studying her. But it's inspirational to have role models like that, and Pittsburgh represents a great tradition of many, many role models that we're able to draw from. And there's a young drummer, Jeff Watts, who I'm sure a lot of you know, who's here in New York doing very, very well and, you know, carrying on the great tradition of Pittsburgh drummers, great drummers.
Yeah.
So I want to say hi to everybody and thank you to everybody for letting me share those 4 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a great experience.
Well, hey, Jerry, there was a lady who plays piano here in Pittsburgh, and she wanted to know about your equipment. She wanted you to talk about your equipment from piano to synthesizers, and what kind of equipment do you have at home, and what do you prefer?
Well, piano is sort of my basic, the place that I always start from. That's because that's where I started. And there's something very organic about the acoustic instruments. Excuse me. So that even when I use synthesizer, I try to use it in the context of what acoustic music means to me. So synthesizers become instruments that are maybe more exotic in the sense that they're not necessarily easily gotten here in this country, or people say, for instance, instruments from Bali or instruments from different parts of Africa, instruments from China, they have the capacity through the synthesizer to sample these instrument sounds, and you have access to them through these synthesizers now. So my interest has been to utilize these instruments as parts of in an orchestrational way in my music, and try to make them sound as organic and natural as I can. You know, that's been my interest in the synthesizer, basically.
Well, there's a question too about Monk. I mean, how did Monk's music more or less touch your music?
Well, again, Roy Brooks comes into the conversation. Roy Brooks, I remember during the, I told you about the recital, both he and Marcus spent a little time up there in residence, artist in residence, and we wanted to do a around midnight for one of the pieces for the recital, and Roy was going to be playing with Roy and Marcus were both playing in that piece, and we were rehearsing it. And so Roy stopped me, and there was a whole lot of the students were there and everything. And Roy stops me and says, you know, this isn't the way that I was playing. It wasn't really representative of the way I wasn't interpreting it right, you know. And the way he said it and the way he stopped me, something I'll never forget, you know. And it had a big impact because I was listening a lot to Herbie Hancock at the time. And I'm very influenced by him, by his playing, as many pianists from my generation are. And at that point, I realized that you can't use, well, you can, but I mean, it became important to me to try to address each composer in a more in a way that was more directed in the way that they really their music really sounded, the way that they approached their music as best as I could. And from that I sort of really started listening more deeply to Monk, and Roy was a direct influence on that. He has a lot of I don't know, the old musicians are always the ones, you know, that many times I've, you know, been directed in ways that I couldn't be directed in any other way but through people who really were there and experienced the music firsthand.
Well, I'll tell you what, here, there's an album here called Homegrown, which is a very nice album, and you tackle Monk's Round Midnight. And I want to give the people a chance here to see how you tackle Monk's Round Midnight. In case you get a late start, folks, we're talking to Detroit native, but we kind of adopted her, Jerry Allen, this morning. 661-9100 is the number, so Jerry, if you can hold, we're going to play Round Midnight, okay?
Okay.
That was nice, and we just heard Around Midnight being performed by the young and talented and very lovely and a mother-to-be and a good friend, Jerry Allen. Jerry.
Let me see.
Hello?
Okay, I'm here.
Uh-oh.
Okay, I'm here. I'm here. There was something that I wanted to ask you about Monk. Do you think that his compositions were really hard to play for you as a pianist?
Yes, they were. And they still are. I mean, it's... I don't know if you all have seen that film that's come through. Straight No Chaser, has that come through Pittsburgh?
No, unfortunately not.
Well, this film shows Thelonious Monk with actual footage of him. Somebody who was, I don't know who did the filming, but it was someone who had to be very close because they were there throughout the tour in all of these different intimate settings, in the studio, at home with Nellie, at the Vanguard, and all of these different places. You know, you got to see him himself, and not somebody else's, Hollywood interpretation of what that was. And you heard him play. And there was one, I don't want to give the film away, because you haven't seen it yet, but just, there's just one Thelonious Monk. And, you know, so when you come to playing the great compositions, there was a use of space and the things not to play that were so profound, you know, that it's very difficult to reinterpret that music because it's already done. The mastership at which it's already done makes it very difficult, you know. But I love the music and the challenge of it, and the best I can do is just bring what I have to bring to it, you know. But to have the opportunity to hear the original versions of that music is where you really hear the magnitude of just the music at its greatest. And to be able to see him and watch the way he moved and the rhythm and the way he talked and the things that he said and things he didn't say, the way he dressed, how he would dance on the bandstand when the music felt good, all those things, you know. It was really an experience, and I hope everybody gets to check it out. You know.
Well, Monk was something very, very special to the music, but there was somebody else who captured your heart, too, as far as a piano player. Well, I know that there's been quite a few, but these two guys really need to be mentioned. Well, Monk, of course, and Mr. Herbie Nichols. Can you talk a little bit about Herbie?
Wow. Well, they were contemporaries, you know, and it was always interesting to me because I felt real connections between the two of them musically, and I didn't know why. And I still don't know how much, they interacted or anything, but I became very attracted to Herbie Nichols' music also through records and through some of the musicians that I've worked with who actually played with Herbie Nichols here in New York. And A.B. Spellman's book, Four Lives, he spoke about Herbie Nichols. And that was the way that I got closest to the man himself, the personality, was through the book. But through the music, it was just the sound about it and something that I feel very akin to, you know, that I'm... It's sort of like whenever you take up a classic repertoire of music like that of Monk or that of Herbie Nichols, I found it really necessary to sort of dive into one and just stay in there for a really long time and listen and listen and experience it. And obviously, I'm not of that generation, that time period. The things that were going on that Thelonious Monk experienced, or Herbie Nichols experienced, or that was a time. There were specific things happening in the black community. There were particular things very special to that era that you feel from the people like Joe Harris when I, or like from John Malachi when he was living. There's something very particular and special. Or my father, from the generation of people that I could never bring to that music. So all I can do, the best I can do is bring what it is that I have from my experiences growing up here in this world. And the thing that I've gained from one of the major things that I've gained from people like Herbie Nichols or Thelonious Monk, or people that were really individuals in their own time, was that there was an obvious courage and obvious kind of power that they had to stick by what they believed in musically, even under duress at some time. People were saying they couldn't play. And I mean, you read some of these downbeat articles from that time, and you can't believe some of the stuff that you read.
Yes, tell it like it is, because believe me, I have read some ridiculous stuff and downbeat about Monk that was crazy.
Yeah, and it's just what they had to go through to stand up and be who they were was, it was a lot. And so for me, I'm trying to look at the fact that you have to be strong in your belief of what it is that you have to give. And through my own music and through my own writing, I'm just trying to have the courage to do what I hear and what I believe in, even when there are times when people really don't like it or you can't get work in places because it's not necessarily what people want, you know what I mean? But they have given me the courage or to say, okay, well, that this is something that has to be done, that's important to be done. And I'm finding my way of doing it and surviving and living, and trying to grow. And at the same time, going back and continuing to play music that's from the tradition, as well as trying to develop my own compositions and ideas musically.
Well, you know what? Something that I found out in your playing, even finding joy, even in the midst of that adversity, you tend to like to go for stuff that highlights enjoying like your own life. You know what I mean? And I think that's important.
I think that's the most honest way for me to approach it, is to just to be very honest. There's ebb and flow in life, where things are going really well and then things are not going as well as you'd like. And it's sort of like, there's a lot of struggle out here, but I think that the way that, you look at it really makes a big difference. And so when I come out of a period that might have been a very difficult period, a lot of times some music will happen that will speak to that moment, you know, and the way that what I've come to learn from that experience. And for me, it's really, when I look back to some of that stuff, I say, well, I mean, that's really putting your life on your sleeve in a way, you know, but I've felt it's very important to be just, you know, honest about what's going on, you know, because everybody's got their struggles. And I think music has been something that connects all people because of that, you know, because of the because it's life. I mean, the experience of music on stage. I mean, when you hear live music, you hear life. You know, you see. Sometimes people are able to get to the ideas that they've been trying to get to, and sometimes they're not able to get to them. But it's the process of doing something, and I think that really makes it, you know, us be able to all relate to it. We're trying. We're all trying to live the best way we can. You know?
That's right. I'd like to take a little break here. This is Independent Radio 91.3 WYAP. I'm Butchie Perkins, and we're interviewing the lovely, talented Jerry Allen this morning, and the number 661-9100 if you would like to ask the question that maybe she can answer. But the number here is, like I said before, 661-9100. Jerry, this next track called Shuffle Montgomery is a Herbie Nichols composition, and it features Charlie Hayton on bass, Paul Motion on drums, and yourself on piano. 661-9100. Thank you. Oh yeah, that was my baby tackling a number called Shuffle Montgomery, a Herbie Nichols composition. And if you happen to be worrying about, well, who's his baby? I'm talking about Jerry Allen this morning. This is my baby here, and I'm going to put old mommy on the phone a minute and see what she has to say about that particular number. I think I disconnected by accident. I tell you what, we're going to play some more music, okay? Here's Jerry Allen off her newest LP called Twilight, and we're going to hear a thing called When Kabuya Dances. Very danceable When Kabuya Dances with Jerry Allen on piano here, and along with Jarabu Shahid on bass and Tani Tabal on drums, from her latest LP, Twilight, from Verve Records. And Jerry's back, and she's excited about being on. So let me see if I can get my baby in here for a minute. Thank you. Let me see if I can get Jerry in here now. Okay. Tell you what, folks, if it doesn't work this time, we're going to have to give it up on Jerry and do this another time. So keep your fingers crossed. Let me see. Jerry.
Jerry. I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to see if we can talk anyway here. Let me see if I can get it together.
Now, can you hear me now, Jim?
Yes.
I don't know if it's going over the ear or not, but hold tight. I'll call you back later.
Okay.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
looking for someone else's new vision. A small boy grows, and perhaps he has survived. Look now how he walks with keys on his hand. No longer a boy, not thank you.
And I couldn't get Jerry back on the phone. I got to get an engineer down here when I do this kind of thing, folks. Because when it goes bad, well, you know, and I'm sitting here with tears in my mouth. I really wanted to talk to my baby. I mean, I'm serious about that. And when I called her back, she said, "Hey, Butchie, you know what? There were so many people who I wanted to say hello to. And don't feel so bad." I said, "You know I feel bad. You know it." And she says, "Well, let's make a date." And I says, "When?" I said, "Because I'm wore out about it." She says, "When?" I said, "I don't know." So I says, "How about Friday?" She said, "Friday's a date, honey." I said, "Okay. So next Friday, you know, we're going to talk to my baby again." Oh, I'm so drugged. 661-9100. But it happened to be an overall all right morning so far. 23 minutes after the hour of 9. This is Independent Radio 91.3 WYAP. The name of the album you're hearing right now is Jerry's latest, called Twilight, from Verve Records. And we opened up with When Kabuya Dances, Shadow Series, and a tune called Skin. Right now, you're hearing a tune in the background called A Place of Power. Following that, the title track, Twilight. The vocals done by a very dear friend of Jerry's called, her name is Clarice Taylor Bell. Brand new from Verve Records. Oh